Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Chips and Tips podcast. I'm Tim Paul from Toolpath. And tonight we have my buddy James Mayette from Selway joining us. James, I really appreciate everything about you. Thanks for joining us tonight. And I like to kind of start this off with I give an introduction of who you are. And we see how good I did, and you come back and clean that up. Does that work for you?
Yeah, that works awesome for
me. Okay. I try to have some fun with this. I have a beer right before we start, so I get my nerves out. I'm pretty shy. A lot of people don't think I am, but okay. So I think of you as the super senior application engineer with a team of pretty big rock stars over at Selway.
Yeah.
I'll share my story of how I first met you. I think I shared that over a text pretty recently. I think of you as the Camplete assassin, Matsura whisperer, Fanic master, longtime master cam, super geek, fusion dabbler. We'll call it a dabbler.
Yeah.
An early Toolpath user breaker guy. overall certified machinist badass. And in this episode, we want to get to learn more about you, dig in a little bit about like some triggering moment, not triggering might not be the right word, but some kind of key moments in your life that got you into the direction we're at.
Sure.
I want to call out Dylan, our buddy Dylan over at the Within Tolerance podcast. Had a really good episode with you. We'll have some overlap there, but
sure.
If you want to learn more about James, our buddy Chris Appetini and Dylan did a really good podcast with you. I think it's episode 217, if anybody wants to go do that. So now is your opportunity to clean up anything I butchered. But beyond that, share a little bit about yourself, what you do your day-to-day, and how you describe your role at Selway, and then we'll get into my lightning round. I think we'll do next.
Well, you pretty much nailed most of it. I don't know that I would classify myself as super, but I am indeed a senior applications engineer with all the gray hair to that goes along with it.
You're only 25. You look great,
right? 25. Yeah. 27 years or 26 years ago, something like that.
Married for over 30 years, and I'm only 25. Yeah, so
yeah.
Keep going.
Camplete assassin. Guilty as charged. I love that piece of software. I am forever grateful to Mike Kaminsky for pushing us into getting into it. I think I was only with Selway a couple of months before I got an email from him, and it was kind of like, hey, why aren't you using Camplete? And at that time I hadn't even heard of it. And so later on that year I got the software, and later on that year learned it and have been using it, abusing it, and learning about it almost every day since.
It's almost like you're serving up the story of our first real meet. So keep going.
Right?
Keep going.
Matsura whisperer. Yeah, sure. There's in our line of business, you don't always get to work with a product that essentially sells itself. Matsura is one of those products. When it comes to multi-palette, multi-axis machining centers, five-axis machining centers, it's just a fantastic product. And our customers, you know, come up with a lot of creative ways to maximize and leverage the power that's in it. So I hopefully impart some of my experiences along the way so that they can, push it even farther. Fanic Master. I love Fanic controls. That's been the control that I've spent the most amount of time with. I think Fanic gets picked on a lot.
Yeah.
And so like it's almost to the point where the Fanuc gets bullied, and I don't like that. So I'm like, you know, it's a seriously powerful control. And I think a lot of people just think about what it was 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and they just haven't grown past that. And it's like, man, that I've been doing, you know, this, that, or the other thing with it for 25 years now. What's missing here? What can we teach you? What's the piece that's missing for you? So I just enjoy, you know, putting that information together for customers and people online and anybody willing to ask.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome. Keep going.
Yeah. Mastercam. I first got started with it. I think it was 1992 or 1993. It was literally DOS. You know, people still accuse it of being a DOS program, but I mean, it was literally, there was no graphical operator interface for PCs at that time. It was, you know, boot up to a black screen with green text, and that's where everything started. So I've been using it that long. Enjoy it. You know, get mad at it just like everybody else. Figure out how to work within. Figure out what it wants. You know, it's like anything else. Yeah. Figure out what it wants, and then work towards that. And you know, expose some bugs here and there, and you know, have fun with it. Fusion. I've said this to a lot of people probably over the last year that. Fusion is no longer a toy. It is a full-featured CAD CAM software package now. I mean, it's probably on the lower end of the mid-range for assembly modelers, but for everything that I ever do, it would probably do it well. I use Inventor for my CAD package because a lot of the stuff that I work on is ITAR, so it's got to stay local. Yeah. So I do that. But the times that I've done a couple of programs for customers using Fusion, and was able to figure out what it needed and how it needed it, and with one of your coworkers from, I think he's from New Zealand. He might be from Australia. Scott Moyes.
Scott Moyes,
that guy's a rock star. He really helped me out and showed me how to add menus in Fusion so that I can basically turn switches on to turn stuff on in CAMplete. So, I mean, it's freaking awesome, man.
I generally feel stupid most of the time, but there's a few people that make me just genuinely feel kind of like a dum-dum. And not by anything he does other than just being smart. He's one of the few that I'm like, freaking guy. That's awesome.
I was so grateful. Like he, you know, he took time out of his day or his evening or I forget how many hours.
It's a lot different. That's what I know.
He took time out to show me, you know, how to add that stuff and everything. And I just, man, just over my career, there's been so many people that have poured into me one way or another, and he's another one of those guys that has made me better. So I am super appreciative of him.
I have him on my world clock at 21 hours different. Yeah. I'm always like, why are you blowing me up on Sunday?
Sunday.
That's awesome.
Early toolpath user. Yeah. When I first heard what you guys were doing, I knew that you guys were going to need some projects to, break your teeth on. So yeah. I figured I've got some stuff laying around that maybe might be a lofty goal for right now, but you know, a goal regardless. And so I sent you guys some stuff, and I'm super grateful that you gave me the opportunity to do that. And I've used it for a few different things to, like, the very first part that I programmed in Fusion, I actually ran it through Toolpath. Toolpath got me like 80% there. And I was, and I was able to look at it and figured out how it did things. And oh, okay, this how this toolpath works. Oh yeah, I've got to turn the plane on so that my Z-axis is going the right way, and stuff like that. So it's been an educational tool for me too.
That's amazing. So at Toolpath we have Slack, like a lot of tech companies do. You shared that with me when that happened, and I remember being like, everybody listen, James Myatt, you know, I've been messing with this guy for 10 years about Fusion. And I was like, I don't even want to dig into the details yet, but this is a big moment. So
it's been
fun to watch you, bang around on Toolpath. I try to make sure this podcast isn't just about Toolpath or even mostly about Toolpath, but it's been fun to watch you bang around on Toolpath. My assessment, correct me if I'm wrong, you normally work on kind of gnarly stuff. And I'm always like, whenever the James Myatts of the world come along to play with my software, I'm like, it's time to get to work. And so for anybody listening that doesn't know, I worked at Autodesk for almost 11 years. That's where I met James Myatt. Anyways, it's been fun. It's been fun to watch you kind of just ask smart questions. I see your, you know, we're kind of coming closer to where you want to be, and it's been pretty fun. I don't think it's not super hidden news. I just started testing R3+2 stuff, which is pretty exciting. Mm-hmm. I think you'll be able to start testing that before the year's over. So that's nice. Should be more relevant to most of what I think you do. So
all I need is you guys to put stuff all around apart. I can pull it into Fusion and move things around as I need. So it's like,
So actually the bigger part of, I mean, just 3+2 is not that incredibly hard. As far as automating anything that we do is kind of hard, but, we've set an expectation of ourselves. Like, it's dumb to do 3+2 without doing the work holding that goes along with it and the tool matching that to not bang into your work holding and all that stuff. So, should be some fun stuff for you to try, and I'll specifically reach out when you have access to it. So
sweet.
I think we got through the opening stuff.
Yeah.
Our buddy Dylan, I'll call out him again, episode 217.
And I think I was on with them at IMTS also. So one of the IMTS days too.
That was after that one, after your first one, right?
It was after the first one. Okay. And that one was kind of a little more impromptu, kind of conversational. Yeah.
I remember seeing you in the room. I remember being jealous that you were sitting down because my feet were my feet were barking. Yeah.
Anytime I can sit down at a show, I do it just because it's a painful situation.
We paid an extra bazillion dollars for the extra thick padding, but it was
worth every penny.
I was there for a couple weeks, so by mid show week, I was pretty worn out. Let's talk real quick about so you know, I'm jotting down notes, so I'm not like looking down and not paying attention, but. So one of the things I want to talk about was what's your kind of day-to-day I know you do a ton of complete training. I don't know if I need a percentage, but yeah, if you can kind of throw out like, hey, such a percentage of my day is to that. And just describe your kind of role as your super, let me see what it said, super duper senior applications engineer.
Well,
I added one.
Yeah. So one of the things that I love about my job is there's not really a quote unquote typical day. But if I were to just, you know, take a 20,000, 30,000 foot view of what goes on, I usually will, if I'm already, you know, getting ready to be at a customer, then, you know, we go in there, actually, let me back up. So part of my job entails a fair amount of travel. So a lot of times on Monday mornings, I'm flying somewhere. On that flight, I'm answering emails. I'm doing support for what we sell, answering questions for sales guys, things like that. And then when I get to my destination, you know, go pick up the rental car and then drive to the customer. Sometimes I'll take a phone call or two, or more, just depends on what's going on. And then I get to the customer. So if the machine is brand new, then I go through, there's some parameters that we change based on what the machine configuration is. And then I'll do, actually, before I do that, I do a full machine backup. So just in case lightning strikes, we can resurrect this thing back to factory standard. And then I, you know, I'll make some changes, do testing. If it's a multi-pallet machine, I will run all the pallets into the machine and out automatically just to make sure that they do that. We'll do some tool changes. Yeah. And then I start training the customer. And then that.
Now this is all on a Haas mini mill, right?
Oh no. Yeah. I think the last mini mill that I put my hands on was probably around 2001, 2002.
Okay. I'm not knocking the Haas mini mill. No, they are what they are, hey. but I'm specifically calling out, you tend to work with kind of specific stuff, right?
Yeah. Probably 90% of the machines that I put my hands on are multi-pallet five-axis machines. Matsura comprising the majority of those.
It's almost like I knew the answer.
Yeah. I do. I'm not allowed to actually do Haas stuff for our company because of where I live. So I live in Utah and we don't have Haas in that territory. So I'm not allowed to do that.
Can you remind me who the Haas dealer is in there over there?
If I had to guess, I would say it might be Productivity.
I think you're right.
In Utah?
Okay. I think you're right.
I don't know that for sure, but I believe that's what it is.
Sounds right-ish. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We're back to the day-to-day, right? So you make sure the machine's kind of moving around and dancing like it's supposed to.
Yep.
And then what?
And then I get the whoever the owner has designated as people that will get trained, and I've trained one single person. I think the largest group that I ever trained was 12 or 13 people.
No kidding.
I had to dig into my Scoutmaster bag of tricks to pull that one off. So,
no kidding.
In Boy Scouts, they have this thing called the Edge Method, and it describes an effective way for training. And so E is explain, D is demonstrate, G is guide, E is enable.
I just wrote that down. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so what I did was I took three guys and I showed them. The rest of the people were kind of off in the background. I took three guys and I showed them. And then I said, okay, you take the next three people and you show them, and I'll stand here on the side and make sure that everything gets covered. And then you're going to, and then the guys that you train are going to train the guys behind them. And we did that through everything. Obviously it took a little more time than it would normally, but everybody got their hands on the machine and, you know, learned something. So sometimes you have to get creative in this job.
Yeah, I love that. I've done more than my share of teaching some sort of machining, lots of different stuff, but I think I've just kind of found my way to something similar. It's good to hear that. I wrote it down because I want to circle back to that. You mentioned travel. Do you travel more now that you're in just outside of Salt Lake than you did when you were in SoCal?
I think right. So my answer is kind of skewed right this minute in time.
Yeah.
We're extraordinarily busy right now. So I've traveled like a lot over the last time. We've got a couple members of our team have had some things that they've needed to take care of, personal things. So whenever that happens, whoever's around, you know, picks up the slack. So it's been my turn to help out my teammates and happy to do it. I did wave the timeout flag a couple of weeks ago because I was just like, I've got to be home for a minute. I'm
good for you.
I'm tired. I need to recharge. I need to do laundry, you know, I need to winterize my house. I just, you know, there's just a lot of things that don't happen when I'm gone. And I've got an amazing wife that handles like, you know, 95% of the household stuff, but there's just those 5% that she can't do. And so I've got to handle that stuff. So
that's good. Travel, I was a road warrior for quite some time. We've been together on the road more than a few times. life, gnarly life stuff happens when you're on the road. You've been with me through some of that. You think you travel weekly? On average, you think it's pretty often your weekly travel, right?
Yeah. Usually I'm leaving Monday, sometimes Tuesday, and then I'm coming back on Friday, sometimes Thursday, but that's usually, I'm home on weekends probably 99% of the time, maybe 95%, but I'm almost always home on weekends.
That's good. That's good. It's a lifestyle. And you gotta have a strong home life for that to work, which I have almost outside. Yeah. I have a fairly outside perspective that you have a pretty amazing family. So, maybe we'll talk about that here in a little bit. I think we're ready for the lightning. I call it the lightning-ish round because I ramble too much, James. Let's see how this goes. Maybe I'll drop it. Maybe people will share if they think I should drop it or not. All right, ready? Let's go. First machine you ever touched. So I suspect you've turned some handles in your days. So let's go first machine. And then first CNC machine. Let's go both.
So actually, I think it probably needs to be split into three categories because the very first machine that I put my hands on was a bandsaw in wood shop in high school.
Oh, I'm glad you went there. Good. Yeah.
So I did probably two. probably a total of 3 years in high school in wood shop. And then, and then once I got out, the very first machine that I ran was a Bridgeport, no servo motors. It was all hand, all hand turning quill.
Old school.
old school. Yeah. I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was older than I was. Very first CNC I put my hands on was a Mazak VQC11, I think it was. Oh. It was a two pallet machine. It had a Fanuc 6M control on it.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. So this is like 93, maybe?
Damn it, my 92. James, I always feel like we're more similar in age than you start busting out DOS on me and all that stuff. I mean, you're five axis James. So I have to feel like anything worth doing is worth overdoing. So what?
100%.
What was your first five axis? I was going to say multi-axis, but let's go full five axis. What was your first?
First five-axis machine was it was either a Thermaloid or a Motion Master router. And we were doing basically trimming.
Was that a left field? You caught me. They caught me. It caught me by surprise.
It was a head-head machine. So
Even better.
Yeah. Head-head machine is a different animal than a table machine. It's got its place, but I have to say I like a table machine better. There's less to worry about.
I think most post writers would agree.
Oh, totally. Oh man. It had been a long time since I had put my hands on a head machine, and I just recently had to work through that with the customer that got a Toyota with a Heidenheim control. So was the head thing a thing, learning a new control was a thing too. And, learning how to put it all together in Camplete was another thing. So,
Wow.
It's all good.
This is why the lightning round gets screwed up every freaking time. but I'll share it anyways.
Yeah.
When I started at Autodesk, we did almost no five axis stuff. And I found the perfect customer for what they were doing was trimming, which was like exactly what we could do, like very respectably in HSM. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And I was an application engineer for HSM in the early days, and I sold the crap out of that. And then our post guys hated me because it was a head machine. And
yeah, like, that's real head, work.
Head, like 210, 220, whatever it takes, right? Okay. Let's get back to the lightning round. So first cam system you ever used, two-part question, used, ever got paid for? And maybe they're same, maybe they're different.
Nope, they are different. So first cam system that I ever used was PathTrace. Not even Edge Cam.
Are you drinking from the youth fountain?
Yeah.
You don't look like you're 100. okay, keep going.
Sometimes I feel like it. The first cam system that I used and got paid to use was Mastercam.
Yeah. Me too on the second one, not the first one.
Mastercam was actually the third cam system that I learned how to use.
What was the second?
The first one was, like I mentioned, PathTrace, and the second cam system that I learned how to use was SmartCam.
And then then
the third cam system that I learned how to use was Mastercam.
Give me a version.
Okay. PathTrace, I only ever used.
No, MasterCam, nobody's going to know any of that stuff. MasterCam version.
MasterCam
version. I always feel like you remember the versions.
Yeah, no, I do. 3.1. V3.1, not X. V.
Oh, yeah. So I got that part. There's actually people that don't know there was a pre-X, right?
Yeah. So I always stress that. I'm like, no, it was V. It was long before that. So yeah.
I'm always impressed with your memory of that, because I think I was in the nines pre-X.
Yeah.
But I say that with very little confidence.
Eight and nine were great versions. V8, they got full associativity, meaning, mm-hmm. you could change toolpath geometry and just regen as long as everything was okay. That was the first version that had it for everything. I think it was everything.
Yeah. So. Yeah, this is a lightning round. How many CAM systems do you think you've used? Oof.
It's easier if I name them than count them. So
yeah, so we got the first three.
First three. So the next one would be Surf Cam.
Okay.
And four. then after that would be probably CATIA.
Five. Okay.
And then after CATIA, I learned. Next was either Inventor HSM, HSM or Power Mill.
Okay, so we got 6-7 either way. Yeah, it was first or second. Yeah,
and then let's see, Fusion would probably be the last, the most recent one.
So we've got eight total. I'm going to take credit for the last three.
Yeah.
Even though I met you when I was trying to sell you on loving Inventor HSM. Yeah. And I remember showing up being like, man, I don't want to teach this guy CAM. I just want to go hang out. He's got all kinds of hard questions for me. That was fun. I'm glad that happened. So okay, are there any game changer CAM moments, functionality, features that were like, my life just changed?
100%. It was when associativity, toolpath associativity came on board. That was a massive game changer. Cause if you like in the early versions of MasterCam, you would do a toolpath and basically it would add to the NCI file, which is the intermediate file. And then when you got everything done, there was no menu that showed you all the toolpaths that you had in this thing. you just had to remember. And
oh my gosh,
man, there were some tools that were in there that if you were a high end user, you could figure out that would make your job a little bit easier. But man, once associativity came on board for MasterCam, that was a huge deal for me. That was when programming started getting really fun.
Yeah, so my short thing, trying to keep in the lightning round, I started in that time, and I used some stuff I can't even remember, but so I started in that time, and I remember old timers telling me like how lucky my life was. And it's the same conversations I have with youngsters now, right? Where I'm talking to them about. The grand world of adaptive or dynamic milling and we used
to have to draw those tool paths, right?
Yeah. That's, I was one of those guys. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Literally had to draw that. If you wanted that adaptive type cut, you had to draw that out and draw arcs to get it to, loop in and do all that. You had to create the geometry to make that toolpath motion.
It's funny you say that. I've told people there's not a lot of people sadistic enough to do this, but I used to, and I would tell them.
Guilty as charged.
I could have said, I bet you my buddy James is one of those guys.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a pretty good one. All right, now we're going to move into cool things you've ever. We're going to start with like programmed a machine, just some cool stuff that pops to mind. And then we'll give you a couple more.
Something cool that I've have you ever been in one of those bathrooms where they have the big round hand washing station? You step on the thing with your foot. A lot of machine shops have those.
Yeah,
I did a mold for one of those things.
Shut your face.
Yeah,
I love it.
I think we did it with a Thermwood head machine. Yeah. And in the toolpath was a flow 5-axis toolpath, just zigzagging. The head was so down rad. Inside the thing, and it was just going back and forth. And
I love it. I love it.
That was a cool thing for sure.
I thought you were going to space or a medical room or something like that. I love the out of nowhere. Yeah. I'm certain, I have 100% certainty you have saved some things from disaster, some projects from disaster. Anything pop to mind?
Probably. I was a machinist.
Some of these are hard.
Yeah. I was a machinist in a shop in Corona that is, I don't even remember the name of the company. We were an FAA repair station and, we did commercial and military stuff. There was an aircraft on the ground and somebody with some brass on their lapel waiting for this part to get done. That was allegedly supposed to go on an F-16.
That's cool.
That was the story I was told. Yeah. So that's kind of how I have to repeat it.
That's awesome.
So that was a fun project and it was stressful because I didn't have a lot of years of programming behind my belt at that time. So I was like, I got to get this done. It's got to be right. So
That's a good one. I have a note that we'll see how good I circle back to things. So we'll see there. What's the coolest thing you've ever held in your hands, James? This could be a trick question depending on how you look at it.
Any one of my sons.
That's after I wrote that, I'm like, there's only one answer to this.
Pass. Other sure. than my wife's face when we got married,
You passed. That was after I wrote that. I'm like, there's one answer. We'll see how he does. And you pass. You pass. So it's like an IQ test.
Cool.
Career reflection. So this is where we don't need all the details, but what's some of the more important career moments, right? I can think of a few, like, man, if I didn't do this, my life would be less awesome than it is now. Do you have any of those?
Yeah, probably one of the most important career moments is when I was listening to new employee orientation when I was at Cummins, and they explained to us that they have this program called tuition reimbursement. And I was a horrible, horrible student in school. I'm pretty sure that my final cumulative GPA in high school was 2.14. Mm-hmm. And had it not been for shop classes and electives, it probably would have been in the mid-ones.
Yeah, I can relate, James.
So the thought of going to school, but then they were like, hey, you know, if you go and you learn something related to what we do here at work. And I was like, oh, they got welding, they got machining, they got engineering. And I was like, oh, there were a lot of things that really appealed to me. And so I got the okay from my wife and started going to school. And I 100% would not be where I am today if, one, if my wife wasn't who she was. Two, I didn't go to Mount SAC manufacturing technology program at Mount San Antonio College in Walnut, California.
That's awesome. Walnut. Yeah.
Walnut.
The heck? Do
you know where City of Industry is?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, right next to City of Industry on the east side. Okay.
Cool. Let's go. Move. What's the biggest mistake you've ever made in your career? There's a lot of ways to look at this.
That one's easy.
Yeah.
So it's also not only is it the biggest mistake I've ever made, it was probably one of the worst personal moral lapses that I've ever done. So I was working for a company and as a programmer, and I was on salary, and I got the bright idea that I'm programming parts for this company, and then I'm at a remote site managing a horizontal pallet pool system. So the pallet pool system is doing its thing and whatever. And I got the great idea that I should start contract programming on company time. And so I did it. And to this day, I cannot figure out what was going through my head that made me think that would be okay. Because I mean, I'm literally stealing from the company I'm working for.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, that failure, is without a doubt, the biggest mistake that I've ever made. However, that mistake turned into, I think because one, I recognized that it wasn't just a mistake. It was a moral failure.
Yeah.
I had to come home to my wife and tell my kids, hey, I screwed up. I'm unemployed. And, I owned it in front of my kids and everything. And
good for you.
And I have to say that that company was far more generous to me than I deserved when I left. They allowed me to resign.
Wow, good.
Yeah, they paid me through the end of the month. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Was it the 28th or
no? Yeah. This was like the first maybe second.
It was
week
generous.
Of the month. So
yeah,
far more generous than I deserve.
Yeah.
And but when I was confronted with it, I didn't try to weasel my way out of it. I was upfront. I said, I 100% did that. I'm accountable for my failure here, and whatever happens, I've got it coming to me. So
yeah, wow.
What's the next?
That's a good share. That's a good share, James. I like to think I have a pretty good moral compass, but I like to think I own up to any of my failings more than anything. So that's awesome. All right, let's move on to what is your biggest suffer fest moment in your career? That really, what I'm looking for is that also. You persisted and it turned out to be like not that terrible or even great.
Yeah. So the biggest suffer fest, actually was a memorable day also. So there's two parts to this. So if I don't tell you the second part, remind me to tell you the second part. No. So the biggest suffer fest was, I was doing a turnkey for one of our customers, in Southern California. And because of all of the things that go on with my job, it started compressing. The amount of time that I was going to have to do the job was getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter.
Yeah.
Until the machine was going to ship like in 2 days. So, and I hadn't completed it. And so I had to do a 30 plus hour shift.
Bender?
30 plus hour bender. I took a nap under my desk in the Selway, old Buena Park office. Wow. And so I got it done. It got done right. It got shipped out to the customer. And to the best of my knowledge, they're still running parts on that thing. And that's been
awesome.
Probably 15 years now.
And the upside of that, I'm going to follow up with my second part of that. But the upside of that is people notice that stuff, right? That's the kind of stories I've heard about James before I met you. What's the second part of that?
The second part of that is the day that my first grandchild was born. So after a 30 plus hour bender, I show up to the hospital all bleary eyed to see my first granddaughter.
It sounds about like my daughter being born.
Oh man. I didn't stay for very long, but I stayed. I went there and I saw her. I got to meet her and I was like, okay, I got to check out. I got to go home and get some sleep.
That's awesome.
Moving
on. Do you have a favorite CNC machine? There's a lot of nuance to this, but you can just pick one and explain.
Yeah, you know, it's really a toss up, and it would be a toss up between the size of the part. So I'll give you two favorites. My favorite one is the MAM 7235V, and then my second favorite one would be the LF 160.
So here's the good news is that maybe I should have played. Let's see if I can guess. that just means it means we're like a married couple, just without all the married couple stuff. All right. We'll end the lightning round with hopefully a fun, maybe we'll burn down the internet with this one. Minutoyo, Starrett, Brown to Sharp, or do you say Interrapid? That's how I always say it.
Yeah. Bit of toil.
Okay. What's your go-to like resolution or graduations for like a test indicator?
1 micron.
I knew the answer. Anything
we're doing.
that's my boy. I knew the answer. I'm a tenth of your awesomeness.
I'm
a Minutoyo 1/10 guy, but
okay.
This is fun for me. It doesn't matter if it's fun for anyone else.
Right.
all right. Life and career. Now we can get serious. Now I can try to talk. How much time are we at? We're at 49 minutes.
I have unlimited time. I only have to be somewhere in the morning, so.
Okay. My time is just until we're stopped entertaining each other.
Right. Cool.
And hopefully that's also entertaining for everybody listening.
Right.
Okay, so now I move on to life and career. So we'll walk through your kind of life story here. So let's see how I can not screw this up. I will push people to Dylan's podcast again. I think it's episode 217. I think you had a good call out that you were also on. Dylan did one at IMTS in our Toolpath booth.
Right.
I think you're also on like an impromptu one there, right?
Yeah. I think it was the Thursday. It could have been the Wednesday, but I'm thinking it was the Thursday.
Shouldn't be that hard. And it was after 217. Right.
Yeah. For sure.
Okay. So I'm going to cue this up with when I think of James, I think of super high level. Like, I'm not trying to fluff you up too much, James, but I'm giving it to you how I feel. Real high level, gold standard, super geek machinist guy. Possibly maybe I'm fluffing you up here a little bit. The most freaking organized file management guy I think I've interacted with in 30 plus years of me working. The side story to that is I've asked you for some of the most random stuff over the years. And in an insanely quick amount of time, you're like, boop, you've got mail. Like we're talking tool libraries from different vintages of Mastercam and all kinds of crazy stuff. That to me is insane. And I look up to you for that.
Thank you.
I think of you like your loyalty and friendship, family, business. You come across as a pretty amazing father that hopefully most of us, father and husband, I should say, Sherry would probably agree.
Yeah.
I just said your wife's name. Is that okay?
Yeah,
okay.
No, 100%. My Sherry is my better half without a doubt. And I always love to sing her praises. Okay, I wouldn't be where I'm at without her. So she will often dispute that, but I know the truth. I know the truth.
She's pretty amazing. I've had the pleasure of meeting her. So I'll leave it at that. You have a very impressive family that a lot of people should aspire to be. So I've personally enjoyed our friendship over the last, let's just go with 10 years. And the purpose of this episode is not to, not to fluff you up, but to better understand. I am obsessed with understanding, like, what makes people, I hate to claim any success in the industry, right? But like, what makes people tick? What makes people of some success in the industry? So let's try to unwire James and see if we can figure some trends out. So,
sure.
Let's get into your childhood. Like, have the little like Scooby Doo. See if our editor is worth anything. Little Scooby Doo like music. You mentioned in your podcast with Dylan that your dad worked at Caterpillar or no Cummins. Sorry.
Yep.
Sorry.
No worries.
What my dad would care. So
I care. Believe me, if you wouldn't have corrected, I would have said, no, our engines are not urine yellow.
So what did he do there? And I almost think more importantly, two things I know is that he kind of helped you get a job there. Mm-hmm. What I think is really interesting, like, what did you think of his job when he was there? I'm trying to understand, like, why more young people aren't getting into machining. I'm running around preaching to kids, and I'm just not triggering anything. So that's a couple good questions, right?
So I was born to a blue-collar dad. And in a middle class family, my dad was never ever ashamed to work with his hands. My earliest memories of him are with him and my uncles, fixing cars, doing electrical, building stuff, just doing things with their hands. So that was just like what I was exposed to early on. And it was never something that was to be ashamed of, working with your hands. My mom was an office manager for a finance company. She never really seemed all that like, hey, yay, I love my job. But my dad was like, kind of into what he did, he really liked working with his hands and doing those things. And I've looked at some early writings of my dad back when he was probably junior high school ish. And,
really,
my wife and I have both looked at it and we've kind of determined that my dad was probably dyslexic, not like severely, but enough that it was a problem for him in school. And so, you know, back in the day, college was not a, you just,
that was mine.
You know, you're working with your hands, you know? So
I was very dyslexic. I wrote my name MIT for a long damn time. It's embarrassing. That's what it was. Yeah. Okay. So that's super interesting. So keep going.
I don't think until after I went to, let me back up. So I'm going through school and I'm, you know, doing, you know, wood shop and electronics and we had the junior high that I went to, they had an animation class too. Yeah.
Really?
So I did, my film was a claymation film.
No way.
Yeah. I don't even know if they do that stuff anymore, but, I learned how to do how that all works and stuff like that. So,
I wonder if that was SoCal, right? You grew up.
Yeah.
In SoCal? I wonder if SoCal had an influence over that with the movie industry and all that.
If I had to guess, I would say, yeah, because you know, back in the day, you didn't have to, have some crazy, impressive resume and intern for so-and-so to get the privilege to take out their trash for 6 years and call yourself a production assistant. You know, it was a lot different back then.
Yeah.
The junior high fed into the high school, and the high school that I first went to was Roland High School. And to the best of my knowledge, they still have one of the premier animation programs in the U.S.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
So, and I would imagine it's changed with technology and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, some of the core basics are still the same.
Still the same. You know? Cool.
Still the same. Cool. So I did that. And then, you know, rode BMX early. I think I was like 6 or 7 years old. And so my bike had a coast. So this is 1976. Free wheels weren't really a thing on a BMX bike. It was coaster brake. I got the crazy idea.
Oh, wait, hold on. You said 1976. Okay. I've never asked you your age, and I don't need to, but I'm, that's about the time I was born.
I was born in December of 1969. So I'm a 60s child, just barely.
So we're eight years apart. Okay.
Generation X. I'm proud of it.
Yeah. Cool. Keep going.
Coaster brakes and BMX, and I got the crazy idea that I needed to take apart my coaster brake and grease it, fix it, whatever.
Yeah.
I got it apart, and I could not get it back together. So there were two types of coaster brakes back in the day.
Yeah.
Bendix was one, and I think the other one was Suntour.
Yep, that sounds right. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So those
Bendix
were the two.
Was the main one. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of them had four shoes inside the thing, and then you would, you know, pedal backwards, and it would expand, and then it would slow.
Jam themselves into the hub. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other one had a bunch of like washers and stuff.
Suntour.
So that was the one that I had.
Okay.
I took it apart. I could not get it back together, and I'm in tears because my dad's going to be mad and everything. And, I tried to hide it from him, and you know, he sees the stuff laying all over the place. And my dad, oh man, God rest his soul. He was so patient with me. He's like, no.
Really?
He goes, come here, I'll show you. So he figured out how to put it back together. So he put it back together, and he's like, okay, here's how we take things apart so that we can get them back together.
Yeah. Oh,
so, so he shows me how to lay this thing out like in an exploded view so that you get it all back together in the right order. And I've been doing things. I've been taking things apart that same way ever since.
Oh, what a freaking lesson. So anybody who doesn't know, I started my adult life as a mountain bike mechanic, traveled the world doing that. And I had rebuilt more than my share of lots of bike stuff, and coaster brakes are not a simple thing. And I'll tie that back to, I'm 99% sure my dad doesn't listen to these, but my mom does, so hopefully she'll get a good laugh out of it. My uncle said one time, the difference between a human and a monkey is that a human could teach their offspring things. And that's why your dad's closer to a monkey. as my uncle was teaching me something my dad didn't teach me. So that's a great freaking gift. That's a great gift. I don't want to shortchange my dad, but my uncle was better at teaching some of those things than my dad was.
My dad was an outstanding teacher of mechanical things. Awesome. He taught me how to sweat copper. He taught me how to do electrical and not get shocked. Many things over the years that my dad taught me that, like, a lot of it, I'm truly grateful, because almost everything that I touch day to day, something about it will remind me of my dad, because he was just so mechanical about everything. And so,
is your dad still around?
No, my dad passed away. I want to say about a month after I turned 40, it was totally unexpected. And I was working for Selway at the time, and I was actually up in, so let me back up a few hours. So my dad calls me up at like 8 o'clock at night on a Sunday and says, "Hey, I'm not feeling right. I'm having trouble with my shoulder. Would you mind taking me to the ER?" So my dad has done so much for me over the years. I was like, "Yeah, sure." So I made the drive from Chino Hills to Fullerton, where he lived. Yeah. And so I take him to St. Jude's in Fullerton, and he goes there, gets checked out. They give him clean bill, or they say, you're going to have you have an appointment on Tuesday, so why don't you just come in and they'll give you the once over and all that kind of stuff. And what I didn't know at the time is one of the symptoms that he was displaying should have pointed somebody to the fact that a stroke is either imminent or the not too distant future. So I take him home, and he's on the way home. He's like, "Thank you so much for taking care of me." And I was like, "Dad, you've done so many things for me over the years that, I wouldn't dream of not helping you out." So I go home. It's like 1 a.m. or whatever. So I go home, go to sleep, wake up in the morning. I'm on the first flight to Oakland because I'm up in NorCal doing training. So I wait until about 8 o'clock just to call and check on my dad, because he's an early riser, but I thought, we were kind of up late. Let's do that. So I waited till about 9 to give him a call, and he didn't answer. So I was kind of like, I'll give him one more hour. And so I call again and no answer. So it's like 10 o'clock in the morning, and I call my wife. I go, "I've got a feeling that something's not right." And so we had 3 kids. Right. Yeah. We had 3 kids at the house. No, 4. No. Yeah. All my kids were born at the time. So 4 kids, two were on the younger side. And so she's like, "Okay, I've got to figure out what to do with the kids. I'll do what I can." So she gets on her way, and she gets out there about 11. And she's like, she calls me up. She goes, "Hey, the light's on, car's here. I can't see anything." And so at that time, I'm like, "All right, I call up Bill." Bill Selway was my boss at the time. I called Bill. I go, "Bill, something's going on with my dad. I don't know what. I'm going to try to get home." As luck would have it, that day, was one of the rainiest days in Southern California, and all of the airports were closed. So flights are just hammered. So I'm at the airport, or let's see, I'm closing out my hotel room, and I'm talking to my wife, and the place where my dad lived in an apartment, and they weren't letting my wife get into the room. So they're like, you're going to have to call the police. So my wife calls the police. Well, it took over 2 hours for the police to show up. And so anyways, the police get there, and, you know, he's barely alive at that point. And they get him to the hospital, probably by 1 o'clock or so, maybe two, somewhere around there. That day was kind of a blur for the most part. And I got a flight. I think I landed at like 1 a.m. My best friend Robert picked me up at the airport, took me from Ontario Airport to the hospital that he was at in Anaheim. And then he basically had no brain activity at that time. And so, I think it was the next day, could have been Sunday. Either the next day or the day after that, they still needed to run a bunch of tests to determine if there was any brainstem activity or anything like that. And so they finally were able to determine that he had no brain activity, and there was, you know, he was on life support. So they were basically using machines to keep him alive and everything. And so, so that day I had to do one of the easiest hard things that somebody could ever do, and that's pull the plug on a parent. So the only reason why I say it was easy is because ever since I was a kid, my dad always said, I don't want to be a vegetable. Don't ever let them make me be a vegetable. And I was like, okay, so that makes it easy. Now I've got to actually sign the paperwork to make you not be here anymore.
What was his name, James?
Dale Mayette.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that. You were with me when I lost someone in my family, and I was trapped in a freaking, you know, town. I couldn't get home fast enough, and so I always remember you as being one of those people that were there. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. That is,
I remember one of exactly the things... where we were when you got that phone call too.
Yeah,
I remember where I was sitting on the table, and I remember that time. And man.
It makes me so I broke my neck and back a bunch, you know, 6-7 months ago, and I do a lot of sitting around and thinking about life, and I always say, like, make sure you're happy with how things went today, because you don't know what's happening tomorrow. And I imagine you appreciate the time that you had with that, you know, with your dad.
To say probably a goodbye that people would dream about, because I got to do something for him, and that was our last memory together. And so, you know, a lot of times, you know, people regret, you know, oh, I wish we would have mended our relationship. I wish, you know, whatever. You know, I obviously I wish that I would have been able to see him, like, you know, awake and then pass away. But, you know, by the same token, I'm grateful for the way that it worked out too.
Yeah. I, not to try too hard, but, you know, Chips and Tips, you know, Machinist podcast, I can very easily tie that kind of stuff back to our trade. I've been in several industries. Machines definitely the one that I've been in the longest. And some of the gnarliest working, especially like hours length kind of people I've ever interacted with are machine shop owners, applications guys. The industry just puts in a grind. And hopefully people take this story as like, you know, let's all make sure we pause and we're right with people we love and care about.
Yep.
Not to make too big of a deal of it. You were in town recently. My head's still messed up from banging on the ground.
We were
chatting like we were going to get together, and I just went like nowhere because my brain just has been forgetting stuff like that. And I remember being like, ugh. So I care about stuff like that, and it's minuscule compared to what we're talking about, but. Adds like a heaviness to that kind of stuff.
Just the fact that you and I text back and forth when we do, you know, we'll get together, we'll eat, and if, you know, if we don't, we'll chat by text or by phone call. And any time I get to spend with you, Tim, is always time appreciated.
You too. I'm happy to still be here, have time to spend. All right. Let's move on to the hands-on here. So that was, I like to think that, I mean, that gives me a good picture of, you know, the character that's behind who you are. And and actually, I think that tells a lot about who you are. Let's get into a little bit of hands-on years. So I believe I know that your dad helped you get a job at Cummins.
Yep.
And that's how you were kind of exposed to machining as a potential career. Am I right?
Yeah, that's really where it was like, all right, here we go.
Let's talk about, I don't want to rehash our story, you know, from the With Intolerance podcast, but let's try to break it down into some milestones or things that kind of like, man, I did this. So you talked about the tuition reimbursement. That kind of bumped you to like a new potential. Any other like decisions or like, you know, Bill believed in me to do this or something that kind of propelled you forward?
Yeah.
Especially the things that made you maybe feel uncomfortable. Because I think that's where I love to kind of nudge people out of their comfort zone.
Yeah. So probably... where I first got really uncomfortable is after Cummins had they announced that they were closing our facility, and they were letting people go based on seniority and all that kind of stuff, and I had already been released. Well, I went to go work in a shop with one of the guys that I was in at Mount SAC, because when you go to community college, if you go there for any period of time, you start to see the same faces and you start to forge friendships and you know, hear about what's going on in the area, who's hiring. I think they call it networking. Is the formal name for it.
James, I just wrote down networking. we'll circle back to that as a whole topic. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the guys that I met in my class, I think his name was Henry. His last name was Alvarez, and, super, super cool dude. He was working in a shop and he said, hey, my company's hiring. And, you know, if you're looking to make a move or whatever. And so I was like, yeah, sure. You know, because he had been programming, like at that time, he had been doing it for years. So I'm like, yeah, if I can sit under a guy that's, you know, a good programmer. And he said, oh, I'll teach you. And, you know, so I took that opportunity and went to go work at that shop, and I was there for, I don't know, certain number of months. I don't remember exactly how long. And then I come in the morning and his toolbox is up on the forklift getting ready. He's getting ready to put it in the back of his truck. And I'm like, dude, what's going on? Oh man, I'm going to work for TRW or FedEx or something. He's going to work out in out by LAX doing stuff. And he's like, Hey, there's a job in here. Harry's going to probably have you, program it. I think you can do it. I've seen your work in class and just don't let them get on your nerves and just get it done. So that's I was cool. Like, all right, here we go. So, that's, you know, cool. I'm loading a part in the machine, and the boss comes in and he's all frantic, you know, where's Henry? And I was like, you didn't get the phone call? I don't know. You should call him.
His box ain't right there anymore, though. I know that.
I don't know if he was paying attention to that or not. So I was just like, I don't know. So then, you know, comes in and he's like, this job's like super hot. You know, can you do it? And you know, I look at it and I was like, yeah, I think I can do that. And it was I don't remember the full name of the part. But one of the names in the title block was Longeron, so it's part of a thing inside the aircraft that they tie sheet metal to.
Okay.
So
that's cool.
Yeah. So it was like that, and it wasn't too complicated. And actually, I improved on it. So they had done other ones similar to that. This was a different dash number, so there's maybe a few more holes or a few less holes or whatever. Yeah. So I had figured out that I could use a full radius saw and do undercuts.
So yeah.
So I figured out how to do that. So I cut an operation out of the part, and That was my first.
That's so rad.
I was super uncomfortable. I was not prepared for it, but apparently I was, because you know I got it done, and it was so. From the very first class of CAD/CAM that I took to that point was about 3 years.
Okay.
Two and a half, 3 years. So. I always tell people, you know, when you're, you know, you want to have a handle on something before it's expected, before you're ready for it, because when you get your opportunity, it may not be the perfect opportunity. You may have to pull a rabbit out of your hat. And if you don't have all the tools in your bag to get it done, that may be the only opportunity to do that thing that you may ever get. So you want to be ready for it. So
that's a trend I see. I'm certain you've seen it countless times. There's so many awesome people in our industry, and I think there's a big portion that are kind of like me, like foolish and hungry, you know, too dumb to say no. And then there's like a bunch of smart, accomplished people that are like really hesitant to like take that next like push, right? And that's a good one. You know, kind of be ready for it before it shows up in your lap, right?
That's good. Somebody famous in history made the quote, "Luck favors the prepared," or something. I think it's something along those lines. And I don't know where I first heard that, but you know, that kind of idea always was like, that's sound advice.
I like it. So let's try to identify. I can tell you literally, we were talking about being in Salt Lake and knowing that moment. Like, I can tell you the moment that I saw something and was like, I'm going to be a machinist. Do you have that moment?
I do. Okay. What's funny is that I saw it. I can only see it in hindsight. I couldn't see it at the time.
Okay.
So I was, I'm a teenager. I'm in BMX. Everything on my bike is machined. If it's not machined, it's welded. So there's like a rich, I'm surrounded by a rich environment of manufactured things.
Yeah.
So I was horrible in math, still am. I use a lot of tools to make it work.
That's a surprise. Okay.
Yeah. So my dad's bar buddy, Art Hildago, was the drafting teacher at my high school. Well, he was also whatever the idiot math is in high school. It's, you know, addition, subtraction, fractions.
Remedial math is what I remember it being
called.
Yeah,
remedial math. Yeah.
Not that I was too familiar with it, but I was. Yeah.
So I spent all of my years in high school in remedial math. So, you know, that's. Yeah. So anyways, he saw that I was struggling.
Okay.
And he showed me a blueprint. He goes, "What do you see here?" It was for a mechanical thing. It's like, what do you see here? And I'm like, "Oh man, this is this and this is that." And like, and he's like, that's geometry. That's this and that's that. And I'm like, "Well, why can't I do that?" Yeah. And he goes,
that's what I want.
Yeah. So I'm sure he broke all kinds of rules. He let me do drafting for my math class.
Yeah. And
so the very first thing that I drafted was a red line flight crank spindle.
I happen to know what you're talking about. Yeah.
I reverse engineered one with, the circle templates and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, so
I had one that had like a ton of sizes on it or whatever. So calipers were probably super expensive at the time.
Yeah,
but my dad didn't have them or anything like that. So I used that and kind of figured out what the size was and how many. So I like drew red line flight spline crankshaft. So now
cranks,
I'm like, wow, this is
cool. Oh man, there are so many things we can draw from that, right? Like you really, as a culture, we need to do better with connecting with young people, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I am a pretty good math brain, but I wasn't very well educated, right? I cared about girls and football, basically sports. And then I read like the fine print in high school that, you need 2 years of math to graduate. And it like, there was no like minimum level of math. And I was like, oh, well, I wonder if I could just take what I already took in junior high. And I tried it and they let me. and I remember being like, it's working.
Right on.
And then when I wanted to be a machinist, I was like, oh crap. Like, I don't know trig. I don't even know what trig is. What the hell is trig?
So I had to
go learn all that garbage. That's a good insight. So yeah, I've worked with a lot of vocational programs, a lot of high schools. I think as a country, we've done a disservice to our young people with getting rid of shop classes and all that. And hopefully that picks back up. So that's an awesome story. Let's talk about your transition to, applications. I call it application engineering, whatever. I think there was a leap of faith moment there.
There was 100%.
Yeah. So,
I was working as a programmer in a wind tunnel model shop in Orange County. And, this was my first full-time programming gig. So, before that, I had either been a machinist, and a programmer. But this was the first time that I was gonna be sitting in the seat full time, doing the work. And so, I'm there at this company, and it wasn't really out of the blue because when I hired in there, there was all kinds of work. In our in our programming office, they had this tall file cabinet, and in the file cabinet there were blueprints, there were floppy disks, the hard kind, you know, like the little save icon on your your computer. There they look like,
oh,
that.
That's what a floppy is.
So one of those disks, and then blueprint, and then maybe a traveler, you know, for materials and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. So when I first got there, the whole filing cabinet was full. Well, I'm working there and we're working through the parts and doing all the stuff, and nothing's going in. And we get down to the bottom and I'm like, I look over at the other guy. No, we're fine. Well, it wasn't too much longer after that. We're like, hey, we got to let you go. We don't have enough work coming in. And looking back, I'm like, we don't have enough. You don't have any work coming in. But
yeah.
So I end up getting let go, and I was reading CNC West magazine, which we all know and love.
Shout out to Sean. He's working through some health stuff. Yeah,
he is. Sean, if you're listening to this, if it wasn't for your magazine, I would not be doing what I do today. That is 100% a fact. 100%. So
that says a lot.
So
we'll make sure to cut that out for Sean by itself. Yeah.
Yes. And I've had the chance to share with him this that I'm sharing with you too. So, but yes, share it again. So there was in the CNC West magazine, there's ads for different things. And there was companies that, you know, were looking for, you know, outside processing stuff, you know, machining services, things like this. And then down in one of the corners, there's a black and white plain quarter page ad that says, you know, hiring CNC engineers, service technicians, sales, whatever. Guy's named George Shorts. Anybody in the machine tool world that's, you know, over 40 knows who George Shorts is.
Guys, give me a refresher. I definitely heard the name, and I don't know who he is. And I'm
so 48. he is the headhunter for the machine tool world. Like he's the Bill Selway of the machine tool recruiting world.
Got it.
Titan of the industry.
I've definitely heard of him. Yeah.
So I kind of see what's on there, and I just see CNC. So, and he's, you know, jobs. So I'm looking for a job. So I call him up and I go, hey, do you ever get any jobs for, you know, machinists or programmers or whatever? And, you know, every headhunter has at least a little bit of larceny, you know? So he's like, yeah, sure. Why don't you send me your resume and I'll see what I got. Yeah. Knowing full well, he's got no machinist or programmer jobs, but those are the guys that he's looking for. So he's got to play that game to at least find, you know, to find the right people for this industry or somebody that might be the right person for this industry. So anyways, I send him my resume and he calls me back and he goes, hey, I don't have any jobs that are, you know, machinists or programmers. He goes, but I've got something that's related. Do you want to hear about it? And I was like, yeah, sure. So
do you like to fly?
Yeah. So he describes the job of application engineer. And I'm like, I could get paid to do that? Are you kidding me? I'll do that for free. He's like, okay, I just need you to make a few tweaks to your resume. And so I did that. I sent it off to him and, you know, within a day or two, it wasn't too long before I got a couple of interviews. So my first interview was with Morisiki, in Cyprus. So for those listening, this predates Morey DMG. So back in the day, Morisiki was Morisiki, USA, Inc. Inc.
Yeah.
So we were a subsidiary of the mothership in Japan, Morisiki, Limited, something like that. So anyways, I was working for Mori. I wasn't working for Ellison. I wasn't working for Yamazen. I wasn't working for any of those guys. For Morisiki.
For Mori. That's cool.
Interviewed there. Really liked the job. So it like the guy I interviewed with, the job sounded like what I really wanted. The pay was going to be, you know, what I needed. The hiring process back then from start to finish was usually measured in months. Yeah. I was the sole breadwinner in my house. I don't have months. I've got like weeks. So, so George sent me on, I interviewed at, Ellison in SoCal, and back then they were representing, Akuma.
Okay.
So I interviewed with those guys the pay was going to be about the same. And the difference was, do I want to work for a builder or do I want to work for a distributor? Working for a builder is a little less, it's a little more stable, not as subject to the ups and downs of the industry as a distributor is.
That makes sense.
So I was like, man, I've got to get somewhere and be somewhere for a while. Cause I had a bunch of jobs and like, you know, I spent 3 years at Cummins, thought I was going to retire there. Now I got to find something else that, you know, that I can be somewhere for a while. Yeah. So anyways, I end up taking the job at Mori. Like I said, the process to get hired on there took a
long and painful.
Yeah. So Mr. Mori. So the guy that calls himself Dr. Mori today, his dad used to sign off. He had his stamp, and he would stamp every single worldwide employee.
Yeah.
So that's how long ago it was. So his dad put a stamp. I got hired, and then
Dr. Mori's not super
Dr.
young.
Dr. Mori's dad.
Yeah.
Dr. Mori's dad hired me.
Yeah, that's awesome. That is awesome. Okay. So then you're at Mori.
So
Were you there?
Yeah. I was there between 2 and 3 years.
Okay.
So the travel ended up being more than what they said it was going to be. And I was
always,
I at the time when I was there, we had 3 kids at the time. So two were young. I think we had a 2-year-old and an infant. And then, so my wife, you know, she's my wife's been a stay at home mom, stay at home wife my whole career. So she's literally doing all the heavy lifting around the house, and I'm gone for, you know, a lot. So she's like ready to change the locks on me. I didn't sign up for this. It's not what I agreed to. And I'm like, well, okay, wait a minute. Time out. Let me figure something out. And so I ended up leaving, and then when I was looking around, that was how I got tied in with the local Master Cam dealer. They said, hey, we're looking for a guy, you know, you'll have to do some sales. And so I was like, well, okay. As long as I get to do the other stuff too. Oh yeah. There's plenty of that. So I did some MasterCam support and did some MasterCam, did some sales and did a lot of post-processor work. And so, uh, That was where I figured out that I'm not cut out to be a salesman. It takes a different character, it really does. It's a hard job because you have to be able to put aside the 100 no's to go find the one yes or whatever. Yeah. Sales is really a numbers game. You have to go through so many leads before you find where you find the sale. So,
yeah,
somebody would tell me, no, I don't want it. You know, I want to go cry in the corner because I'm like, what? I, how could you not want this thing? You know,
and you're a technical guy. Yeah.
Yeah. What's wrong with it?
I'm certain that you could do sales if it came down to needing to feed your family. And there's a difference between doing it and thriving and doing it and it just killing your soul one no at a time. Right?
Oh man, yeah. It would definitely kill my soul if I had.
Once again, we are similar in that way. Yeah. Yeah.
So when I worked at the Mastercam dealer, so that was a, it started off salary and commission. It ended up being strictly commission. So, yeah. That was a really, really, man, the only reason I stayed on as long as I did is because, Tom Sheeler, who was the, he owned CAD CAM Consulting in Southern California.
That's why I know the name. Okay.
Yeah. In order of awesome people that I've worked for, Bill Silway is number one. Tom Sheeler is number two.
Wow. Wow.
Just an amazing human being. You know, great guy to be around. Love manufacturing. You know, he passed away not too long ago. And his son is now running CAD CAM Consulting. So.
Okay.
Yeah. So while I was working there, I was supplementing my income doing contract programming, which I started doing contract programming when I worked at Mori. Little things here and there, nothing really big, just little stuff. And then working for CAD CAM Consulting was doing the same thing. And then I was also the last year and a half while I was at CAD CAM Consulting, I was teaching MasterCam at the NTMA in their Ontario facility.
I don't know if I knew that.
I mean,
we've talked enough where I've known a lot of your story. This is why I wanted to have you here, but I don't know if I knew that one, James. That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one. NTMA has changed some people's lives.
It truly has. And it's, you know, it's changed my life too. That was where I really, it really opened my eyes as a trainer that I need to look at the process through my students' eyes. So when I'm training a customer today, I'm like, okay, what are they seeing? What types of work do they do? How can I help them see these other things that are going to help them with their process, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so that was where I learned that skill. I remember the very first class that I taught, I had guys that I considered legends and here I'm teaching them. But there's new students in there too. So we're all learning together. And I think that was when I really got the idea that, hey, learning is like full-time thing. You're not ever at the spot where you don't have to learn anymore. If you are, you probably need to go find something else to do because you're just going to mail it in then. So I
also very clip worthy right there. Yeah. Yeah. Oh man. That's our industry right there. Yeah.
Yeah. So I taught MasterCam for nights for 3 years. And it was a great experience, and I'm really grateful that I had that opportunity. And I think the NTMA has changed over time. They kind of I kind of get the feeling that they lost their way a little bit, but I kind of get the feeling now that they're getting back on track again. So I'm hoping that that's the case.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be too politically correct or anything. It absolutely they lost their way. Not that I experienced it before. I've just heard so much good stuff from people. I mean, they've created legends, in my opinion. I tried to help them a bit at my time at Autodesk, and it was right around the time I left that I was like, there might be something here. There might be something here. Hopefully there is. So hopefully they're on that path. Yeah.
Yeah, that's my hope too, because we desperately need it. We need
so bad.
More educational opportunities for people to learn the trades.
Yeah. Speaking of legends, James, again, this isn't supposed to be a fluff piece for James, but a lot of people I respect, I hold myself to fairly high standards. I hold people that I look up to. I don't look up to many, but I hold people that I look up to at a very high regard. I think a lot of people look at you as, you know, top tier super geek for some really interesting brands, right? Campleet, Matsura, Fanuc. We'll kind of leave
right.
it there.
Sure.
What I care most about for this episode is do some self-reflection. Like what do you think it is about your personality that puts you in that spot? Like, you know, people look to me as being good at certain things. I tell you, it's not my smarts. It's like my persistence and my care, right?
Yep.
Do you feel like you've kind of understood yourself enough to share some of that?
I do. So I was fortunate in that when I got into the AE world,
mm-hmm.
like I knew that was like, if we're all puzzle pieces, I knew that that's where I fit. It fit my personality. It fit my need for constantly doing new things with new people. This job feeds that. You know, a lot of people have the need to be in the same space all the time. They need sameness. And we desperately need those people, but we also need people that loathe sameness, because they're the ones that are out there and trying different things and all those kinds of things. And that I think is probably what really clicked. And when I worked at Mori, I was an AE, and then I went to work, and then I did other things, and then I kind of went back to programming, and then I went into consulting for a time. But man, I was always missing that life, that thing that I had at Mori.
Yeah.
And so when my consulting thing was dying out, called my old friend George again, and I said, "Hey, what do you got?" And
I like to weave things back together, right? I think that kind of circles back to that networking thing we're talking about, right?
Yeah,
having George in your network. So keep going. I cut you off.
No. So I call up George. I go, "Hey, what do you got?" He goes, "Hey, update your resume." And it was kind of weird, because usually how it worked was he would say, "Hey, call this person," or "expect a call from that person," or, you know, whatever. He would set the thing up.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bill Selway and George had a special relationship. And so when the right candidate comes across the desk, you know, I have a feeling that, you know, Bill would get first crack or be one of the people that gets first crack at an individual. And it's and at that point in my career, I was seasoned enough now where I think that I could truly thrive. Yeah. And, you know, Bill Selway, if like for those of you that don't know Bill Selway or are not familiar with the organization, in our applications engineering group, okay, I started there in 2007, January. I am the middle guy in our department. There's two guys that have been with the company longer than me, and there's two guys that have been with the company shorter than me. So the number of people whose careers span decades within Selway Machine Tool are numerous. And so knowing that, you know, Bill really did have to take a chance on me because he wanted long-term employees. And I had really only been a couple of places long-term and, you know, a couple of things didn't go my way, but you know, a couple of decisions I made, I had to, you know, do something else. So he had to take a risk on me, and I am grateful to this day, and every single day I try to earn that opportunity. And
I wish I knew Bill longer, as probably everybody can say that has known Bill. I don't want to pretend we were best friends, but I've had some pretty good one-on-one moments with him, and I can clearly say my life is better, you know, because of that time. He's a special dude. I'm not a jealous type, but I'm a little jealous of all your time with him.
Yeah.
And then I
feel like I didn't get enough time with him either, but the time that I spent with him, I didn't understand what a real mentor was until after Bill was gone, because I looked back and I was like, oh, this is what he was teaching me. Oh, yeah. This is what he was teaching me. Oh, wow. He taught me that. So, you know,
I had a couple late nights with him at an important time at my time at Autodesk. And yeah, it was just like he knew what to say at the right time and all that. Yeah.
And true mentorship is an organic thing. It's not, I'm going to sit down in the classroom and I'm going to be your mentor. I mean, not to say that mentorship can't happen that way, but I think the long-term substantive mentoring is organic.
Yeah, I agree. Autodesk had a mentorship program, and I was kind of pushed to join it a couple times, and I was like, I got a lot of mentors, They seem to kind of pop in and out at just the right time.
Here's an interesting factoid about our department.
Yeah.
If you combine all of the manufacturing experience years between the five of us, it's over 200.
Oh my gosh. That is crazy.
Yeah.
And none of you guys, I guess Henry, hopefully he's not listening, but he's pretty old, but
So
none of you guys are super old. Yeah.
We're not super long in the tooth, but we're not kids anymore either. So
definitely not kids anymore. Yeah. What I was going to say was that it's pretty clear the culture that you guys have created. We are pretty focused on culture at Toolpath. I just had a conversation with a customer that I introduced to Andrew Selway yesterday, the day before. And he was complimenting our culture at Toolpath and hoping that he can build that into his company. And Bill honestly laid a foundation, and so many people before Bill and all that. But, you know, you guys do something that I look to, you know. With that, I think I want to share my side of the story, and you can clean it up as I always give the opportunity. My side of the story of our first, funny thing is not how we met, right? I had heard of you. I never interacted with you. So for anybody, let's see if I can reach it. My head does not turn in so good. So this was a fun project. Anybody watching on YouTube?
Yep.
It was a Matsura belt buckle for anybody that's not watching. I had the fun opportunity for at least a good couple of years when I started Autodesk. I was the demo guy, which was maybe the coolest job there is. And talk about being thrown into fire after fire after fire, and I was too dumb to know any better. But Zach Selway, we were drinking late one night, to be honest.
Shocker.
He convinced me to say yes to a demo in not enough time, without enough scope and all that stuff. But we did a really cool demo.
That's how he rolls, by the way.
That's kind of how I roll, apparently. And I said yes. I think I took the belt off of him as inspiration. And that's how that Matsura belt buckle kind of came to life. And I went to Selway ahead of time to kind of set up and get the demo running. Sarah Weirman sent me a bunch of Raptor work holding stuff. Like, yep. Everything just kind of came together very magically with a lot of like trust, right? Because mm-hmm. like if Sarah didn't send the work holding, everything would have fell apart. If you know, so and so didn't send the tooling, and you know, everything just had to come together perfectly. I'd never done any 5X multi-axis demos for Autodesk yet. Back in the HSM day when it was very basic, you know, multi-axis, really 3+2 kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a post that worked. Everything just was scary. But we pulled it off at the Selway Union City office. The demo came together. I was fairly proud of it. It was the cool MX. I always get the
520.
520. I always get the 20 part messed up. So it was a 520 with the wings, the table with the wings, right?
Single pallet. So you had the rotary pallet in the middle, and then you had wings on the side.
Yeah. And the demo was basically a chick vise on left to dovetail two parts. And then we had that Raptor work holding in the middle with, it had four sides, but we were using two for the dovetail. Yep. And then we final opted it in a double grab vise on the right side. And it was fun. I was totally in over my head. Henry, not throwing Henry under the bus, but I trusted Henry. And I was like, I'm nervous as heck that all this, we're going to unpackage it, send it to West Tech. And I'm just nervous something's going to go wrong. And he's like, all right, I got you. I'm going to check to make sure, because it was on a different machine. Right. I'm going to check to make sure everything's the same. And he had somebody at Ontario, the Selway Ontario office in SoCal, check like the serial number, the software version. Everything was like, it's the same damn machine, one serial number apart. And anyways, I met Lance. This is the first time I met Lance Paul. I don't meet a lot of people with the last name Paul, so that was fun for me.
Right.
But I was also very new, I think within just a couple months of being at Autodesk. So I was also super nervous. You know, you guys are kind of legends in at least my world. So I'm going to go screw something up in front of you guys. But that was the demo I was least concerned about because it was freaking dialed. That was one of my late nights with Bill Selway, was up at the Union City office. He was kicking me out at like 9:30 at night. And, so we show up, I've got a UMC demo to run to get set up in the Autodesk booth. And then I got to just quickly, it was like in my dumb little brain, I was quickly going to do the Matsura one because that's the easiest one. And everything went wrong. Everything went wrong. And you guys, I missed West Tech this year because I'm dealing with my broken neck and all that.
Right.
But I saw you guys pulled some late nights, and it just reminded me. I sent you and Lance a fun text message. But here's where you come in. Is Lance was supposed to help me get the Matsura demo. He also had lots of other stuff to do, right? and first freaking thing, I go to put the work holding on. Metric freaking T-nuts. So the tables were like Imperial and then metric. And I was like, damn it. I think we machined some T-nuts on the UMC back of the Autodesk booth, got that going. And then it was just like one thing after another. A tool got broken in transport. We dealt with that. And the coolest part was Lance was just like, dude, it's fine. We'll get through it. The whole entire time. It was like our first big project with Cellway together. My boss, also super cool, John Ott, but he's also like freaking deliver guy, right? He's like, why is this not going right? And Lance just kind of helped everything come along, and then we go to run the program, and the table, the trunnion is rotating the opposite direction.
Right.
Same damn program. And I look at him, I'm like, can you fix this? And he was like, nope. And he's like, let me call James. And I was like, oh no. And I was actually thinking to myself, like, James is going to think I'm a freaking moron. And long story short, that whole interaction with you and Lance, changed how I interact with people when things are going wrong. I probably was okay before, but, my boss gave me $1,000 cash to bribe, the people at the convention center to keep open, keep the air on, keep the power on and all that. Nice. And Lance was like, we've got all night, man. We're going to stay until we get this thing fixed. If you're here, I'm here. Yep. Yep. And 2000 calls later, you were calling people in Japan, like you were having Lance go through like ladder tables. You were doing crazy, you know, complete magic. Long story short, we got it done. And I remember Bill Selway came up to me the next day and was like, I know you guys put in some work. I just want to thank you. You know, it was just very simple, clean. Thank you. I knew it meant a lot. Yeah. And he's like, that's why we're working with you guys. And I was like, okay. And since then, you know, we've stayed in touch and it's been a fun relationship. So,
yeah, indeed.
The main takeaway for me was just everything's fine. I had a friend who lost his son that used to say, like, there's no blood on the ground. Everything's going to be okay. But you guys just had this, like, hey, it's going to be fine. We're just going to keep working at it. Yep. And I've had that same kind of mentality since.
That's every show. I mean,
that was my learning of that. But yeah.
This year, every show, I'm like, oh man, I don't know if we're gonna get it done. I don't know if we're gonna get it done. And when we had this year at West Tech, our time to do stuff was compressed more than it had ever been in other years.
Really?
Yeah. And I was like, in my mind, I'm like, man, this may be the year that we don't pull the rabbit out of our hat. And I'm like, yeah, this is going to suck. we ended up getting some bad information. Somebody told us, you know, you had to be out of there at 5:30 or whatever. And no, that wasn't the case. You can't come in. After
can't leave and come back. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't leave and come back. If you're here, you're here. And once you leave, you're gone. And so I'm like, all right, man, I can grind. I can grind, man. I can work over 24 hours straight if I have to.
Yeah.
Don't like to, but I can. So
that's a common thread. If anybody's looking for threads to something that looks like success in this industry, or I would argue any industry, that persistence over anything is something that has always served me really well. So, James,
I say that failure is not an option because, you know, to me, that's like when people's lives are literally on the line. This is not that. The world will not end if we don't get a demo done. The world will not end if we don't get this thing set up. Is it going to be bad? Yes, it's going to be bad. But like you said, there's no blood on the ground. We're all good. But I still like to treat it like we can't fail.
Yeah, okay. So you were like, if you're watching, I got some dirt bike. My dirt bike days are over, unfortunately. You were at probably the hardest thing I've ever physically done. I did a 24-hour dirt bike race, and I went through some emotional swings to that. But the reason I brought it up was I was the only dude, I was 45, I was the only dude over 29 that entered the Ironman class. And I remember telling a bunch of people that were asking if I was going to win or whatever. I'm like, whatever happens, happens. I'm putting in a winning effort. That's what I'm putting in. I'm putting in winning prep. I'm gonna go until I feel like I can safely, keep riding. Yeah, and that's kind of how I approach so much of what we do in our jobs, right?
Yeah.
Let's go a little different direction. So you, I think I can tease it out publicly because it's not, this gets a little delayed time, but our crazy CEO, Al Lutmo, which we both love, came up with this crazy idea to do basically a machining summit at Mammoth Mountain, California.
Yep.
I don't really need to sell the pitch, but the basic idea is that great things happen when great people get together.
Indeed.
He's reflecting on like the best conversations he's had were like on a chairlift, waiting in coffee lines, whatever.
Yeah.
So he's pulling together kind of magically this pretty awesome event, machining summit at the summit, something like that.
Yep.
And you, he and I were talking about, who's going to come do it. So the basic idea, spend the morning doing some in next, it's coming up in April. Spend the morning skiing with 100 machinists or a couple hundred machinists, however machinists show up. Shop owners, stuff like that. Have great conversations in the morning. And then the afternoon we spend doing some like cool panel conversations, sharing knowledge, stuff like that. And then have fun in the evening. So your name came up, and I hope I'm not screwing this up because I'm a little detached from it, but you are going to be on one of the panels. Is that right?
I am going to be on one of the panels. I just signed up my wife and I tonight. So awesome. We're like officially there now.
Awesome. Awesome. Carol and I will be there. 99.9. What's that?
Is Carol a skier?
She has skied. I think she, if you couldn't guess, I am not going to be skiing.
I wasn't going to let you. Yeah. I like you too much.
My surgeon definitely would not approve. But I think Carol will probably be, hanging out. We'll have non-skiing options for people.
Cool. You can keep my wife has graciously agreed to be a lodge bunny for a few days.
Oh, so, I assumed you guys would be, ripping up the mountains.
My wife's not a skier. She's not interested in it. And,
I'm going to have company with.
Yeah.
Good. Mammoth Mountain is, I get kind of goosebumps. I used to race mountain bikes. I had some of my biggest, best, and worst moments at Mammoth. I did some awesome things and some terribly, terrible, not as bad as my recent stuff, but it's a freaking special place. If anybody hasn't been there, I'm not really here trying to push that either. But that was me kind of transitioning to we have some amazing people on the panels. Carl Bass, you, Jay Pearson, John Saunders. I don't want to screw the rest of the list up, but it's Jim from Sin Cut Sin is going to be there. So let's talk a little bit about kind of bigger picture industry stuff. You've seen in your many years in the industry, you've seen some trends come and go. I'm not asking for any real crystal ball type stuff, but
good, where do you my see crystal the ball is terrible.
One thing I'll share, we were talking about West Tech a minute ago. I was starting a machine shop for L3 Communications, a big defense contractor, in let's just go with like late 2011, early 12. I was just starting the shop. So I had a VM3 with basically all the options kind of specced out. And then I was thinking ahead, like, how I'm going to build out this shop. And we were playing with budgets and whatnot. And I told my boss, someday we're going to be getting a 5-axis machine. At that time, they were definitely all over the place, but it was like baller high-end shops. Impellers was what everybody was talking about. But I remember telling them, like, everything we do has 6 to 12 operations in a 3-axis machine. Yep. Really, we just need some 3+2 stuff on these machines.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
When is West Tech normally? What month, roughly?
Well, so it used to be, so back then, I think it was in March or April.
Okay. I was going to say, and then this year it is different. Okay.
No. Yeah. They've changed it now to be like September, October-ish in that time frame. But yeah, back in the day, it used to be in March, April.
So that's when it was back then. And I walked into IMTS, West Tech. And Haas used to be like big dog in the front. And the machine they had was the very first UMC 750. And it was, I call it the toilet bowl design, that I don't think really saw any sales. But it was a single supported trunnion type thing. And there's a big group of people around, and the price tag, who cares what the price was, but it was basically what I was buying a VM3 for.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, I think my life kind of goes by little milestones or moments, right? And I was like, the world just changed. And that was, to me, like, to kind of tie this back into what we're talking about with kind of where things are going. To me, that was like the world just changed. That was the gateway drug that helped a ton of people figure out multi-axis machining and move over to their Matsura. Tons of people are making crazy money on Haas, UMC still, but it opened up people's eyes, right? And now, fast forward, 14 years, whatever. I know a lot of shops. Their very first machine is a UMC, MX330. And 2011, I don't care how ambitious you were, you just didn't see very much of that. And so I just look forward, and I like to talk to people like you who've seen a lot of stuff. Where do we go from here?
Well, so the biggest trend now is, well, they're on the machining side, is automation. The reality is we're not keeping up with attrition in the industry. We're losing more people than we're gaining. Since we can't get bodies, the only other option is for us to automate, and elevate the guys that we have, or guys and girls, you know, we don't discriminate, elevate all the people in there to, you know, teach them about automation, how it works, and what the things you got to pay attention to, what are the important things, what's not important, things like that. Because when I first started at Cellway, I want to say that probably of our multi-axis machines, so 4-axis, 5-axis, of those categories, it was probably somewhere between 70% and 80%. Were horizontal or 4-axis.
Yeah. Okay.
Today, and then 10%, the remaining percentage was 5-axis. Today, that is flipped inverse. It's
like I've seen numbers of different big Haas dealers and people saying, dude, we're selling more UMCs than we are the BF2SS, which was like the Toyota Camry, right?
Right.
And that's really exciting to me. That's super exciting to me.
You know, what a lot of people still, and we're still having some of the same conversations today that we were having in, you know, like 2007, 2008, 2009, in that time. I don't do five axis work. I don't do impellers. I'm like, well, do you have multiple vices on your table and, you know, attack the part from different sides? Do you have to do that? Yeah. Okay.
All day.
Well, I can do it in, what if you could do that in one operation or two?
Yeah.
Would that make you more efficient? Would that help you maintain tighter tolerances? You know, all of those things. And they're like, oh, I guess I never really thought about it that way. So,
So for me, this kind of general topic, and we don't need to flesh the whole thing out, but that's kind of what I was looking for. I break it into like, what is it? It's like, recruitment and training. There's like software and hardware, right? There's like kind of three things.
Right.
We really need to do something about recruitment and training. That we're 2 hours in. I don't want to make this a 5 hour podcast.
But yeah, it's a need.
So many shops that, you know, we deal with shops at Toolpath. We deal with shops that are trying to figure out their bottlenecks and break through their bottlenecks. So they're talking about equipment. They're talking about, you know, the software that we have. It's just that's a whole topic that actually I would love to have a whole nother conversation about that. Software, to me, you speak on software. I'm not trying to prime you to talk about Toolpath or anything, but do you have any perspectives of where software should be going?
I think what you guys are doing now is the right approach and the right mindset. Being as old as I am and seeing the things that I've seen, I'm old enough to remember that Step NC was going to be, everything else was just going to die on the vine and Step NC was going to save the world. And I know companies threw gobs of money at it, and it just never panned out. And I think the only thing that really panned out on is the neutral format CAD file. That step files are like the standard now. You typically don't lose solid faces. You typically don't open up rat's nests and things like that, like you do with
those days, to be honest.
Oh man, those days are why I'm as good at CAD as I am, because I had no choice. I open up a rat's nest and I've got to unravel it and go, what's this part supposed to look like? And I got to retrim surfaces and blends and do all that stuff. That's where you cut my teeth in the CAD world. So
I had some CAD legends, like real CAD legends, from different brands. Tell me at one time at a bar, some of the best CAD people they've ever worked with were, really machinist CAM people. And there was all those reasons. It was all those reasons.
I think the reason too is because when guys like you and I look at a part, we look at how a tool is going to interact with that part. Yeah. And a designer, usually that's not their focus. Their focus isn't manufacturability. Their focus is, you know, form, function, aesthetics, things like that. And that, don't get me wrong, that has its place. But if you're going to manufacture something, you have to consider how a cutting tool, how an electrode, how a wire, how all of these different manufacturing processes are going to interact with that piece to end up with what the designer intended.
Yeah. I probably have shared it before, but that I've used 7 CAM systems in industry. Two of them were supposed to be automated, you know, cam. I was pretty broken of that concept. Part of what I did at Autodesk was like evaluate technology. The reason I left maybe one of the best jobs in the industry, to come to Toolpath was because of what you just said. What did you say? You said, you and I look at a part about how a tool interacts with the part. And when I was evaluating Toolpath, I was like, this feels right. This feels like the way I think. And hey, we have some arguments at Toolpath about who's the biggest Toolpath critic. Sure. I say I am. Andy and I are battling for the biggest critic is, but
it's good because that's what makes the product better.
Yeah. And the fun thing is we both have a different perspective, right? I'm the grumpy machinist and he's the software leader guy. But we have a long way to go. Velocity is the thing that was never fast enough. I think we've made an amazing amount of progress, but talking about velocity, like multi-axis stuff is the thing. Like we can't get too fast enough. And then I feel like we don't deserve to get there until we do, you know, the table stakes stuff first, right? Yeah. So the good news is we already mentioned earlier in the podcast, I'm very excited about what I'm playing with right now. We had a freaking customer, shout out to Mark if he's listening. He's like, why can't I just take your six setups and just make them tool orientations? And I shit you not, James. Like, I'll make up the time. A couple hours later, the dude is sending us a script that you run in Fusion that basically automates that. And I was like, dude, this is awesome.
Wow.
I said a long time ago when I was building, you know, part of building Fusion, I was like, we hit a really interesting velocity when like independent companies start training Fusion. You know, we're not having to like beg or bribe them to. And when they start making like plugins, like, you know,
when you give as a software company, when you give people the keys to develop add-ins, to automate, whatever, and then people start actually doing that, that's when that's when you're on the right trajectory.
On to something, right?
You're on to something. And there's so many softwares out there that they lock everything down and you can't, you know, you can't change the color on the interface. You know, I don't care if you're colorblind or not, you know, you're going to like this, you're going to like this red and green and you're going to use our product, you know, just like, nah, man, you have to give people configurability.
I agree. That was, I'm not claiming any victory or anything, but I was like, Ooh, I've been on record saying this, we're maybe on to something. Oh, and I mean, one of the things I wrote down was AI. You know, Toolpath is, you know, leveraging this AI engine that we have. The cool thing was this customer, Mark. Hopefully I get to see him at the open house at Selway next week. You're not at Selway Sacramento next week, are you?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Union City.
No. I think I'm in Ogden, Utah next week.
That makes sense. Okay.
I think it's a Haas demo day thing, right?
You nailed it. That's exactly. Yeah.
I don't get into those things.
I'm excited that freaking Selway Sacramento's doing it because that's a little past my radius, my allowed travel radius. So
but
it's within my thing. So hopefully I meet Mark next week. We've been Instagram friends for a while.
Cool.
Okay, so I think we're on the same page there, right? We have kind of a couple categories. A lot of it's being fed by we're losing more people in the industry than we're gaining. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. Shout out to our machine summit at the summit or whatever we're going to call it. Pay attention for some some more information on that. That'll be really exciting. I think what we're trying to do as Toolpath is just pull the community together. You know, Bill Selway used to do this amazingly, right? Is like, yes. just get awesome people together and awesome things happen. And Al is, shout out to Al. He has a similar leadership. So
he does. Any, I always take away good things when I talk to Al. You know, maybe it's time to think about, maybe it's something I need to do, whatever, you know, whenever I talk to Al, I just walk away better.
He's one of the good ones. Indeed. He is one of the good ones. He was my application engineer when I was at L3.
Wow.
He talked me into selling my soul to the software industry. So, you know, James, you know, Mike Witten.
Yes, I do.
Of course, that's a dumb question. You know, Mike Witten, he does work with Selway. I think does some turnkey programming and stuff like that. I've known Mike a long damn time.
Yeah.
He and Derek Goodwin from Trinity. Yep. You may have been there. We were at like the Roadhouse having steak after one of the shows or something. Mm-hmm. And he just sits back and he was like, man, I'm glad I'm not a job shopper anymore. That's a hard freaking life. And I was in the middle of feeling like I'm grinding, man. And I was just like, yeah, he's right. I love the job and sometimes I miss it, but I'm glad I'm not a job shopper anymore. That's the heart of the industry, right? That's actually a good lead into my next section. We kind of need to wrap up. My neck out of a reclined position has a time window before it starts stabbing me in the brain. I call it thought leadership, which I actually hate the term. It sounds kind of pretentious to me, but I'll just kind of more a little lightning-ish round. So we just talked about the job shop. So if I don't think you would be starting a job shop tomorrow, I still have fantasies of it just because I'm sadistic.
That's torturous.
That is torture, right? I don't think I have the balls to do it, to be honest, but I know tons of our customers, that's where we're a really good sweet spot right now, is that, like, you know, grinding job shop. If you were going to start a job shop tomorrow, your son or whoever, and you were, you know, what would be the important things you'd be keeping in mind?
The important things that I would be keeping in mind would be, do the hard things. Don't look for the easy alloys. Do the hard things. Are they expensive? Yes. Are they pull your hair out? Yes. Are they going to age you in dog years? Yes. But those are the satisfying things.
Yeah. I'm biting my tongue. There's so much to add to that, which is just more of what you just said. Yeah. The shops, as I'm sure you do, I have the privilege of seeing and touring and getting to know so many shops around the world, mostly in the country, but the shops that seem to be doing well and riding out the waves are the ones that, like, yeah, I do the hard stuff. I found this niche and I solved this problem that everybody else struggles with. So that's a great one, James. What's one thing that manufacturing software companies still get wrong about how our industry works?
Pass is
always an option, but.
No. I think looking at the posts that I see in Practical Machinist and eMasterCam and the MasterCam main forum, I think that the CAD/CAM companies focus too much on development and not enough on fixing nagging issues for guys. I think if CAD/CAM companies would devote, you know, a set period of time, say, hey, every March all we're going to do that month is we're going to pick off low hanging fruit, you know, whatever it is. Maybe it's a week, maybe it's a month. I don't know, but like set aside a time to say, you know what, we're going to focus on these pain points that, that has been brought to our attention and do that.
I literally had that conversation today. Justin, I did not spoon feed that one. Andy, so, I promise.
The only reason this came as I frequent a lot of internet forums to get the pulse, you know, stay connected and you know, help people if I can or whatever. But like there's just been, you know, things that it's like, man, that, I brought something to MasterCam's attention recently that has been a problem for way too long. And there is not one good reason why they can't fix this one thing. Not one.
Yeah.
And all it is, when you go to open a file, that whole list of files that you have in there, they should be in some sort of order, not look like Kamala Harris speech, just word salad all over the place. There should be some semblance of order. Oh,
love it. Yeah, it seems reasonable. As someone who evaluates requests, seems very reasonable.
I was working on something and I had to open a whole bunch of files and I'm like, I was just so angry. I'm like, that's enough. So I went in there and I posted in the, I'm like, you guys have got to fix this. I don't want to hear it anymore. You have got to do that. And a few people piped in. They're like, yeah, man, you really guys, you need to fix that. So I see it in my lifetime, I'll be happy.
I think that is a good one to end the official part of this podcast. I want to follow up with a couple, just more personal. Let's see how many I want to give you at once. What's consuming your off time these days? Any professional or even personal projects that you're fired up about?
So, consuming my off time, reading a book. It's called Need to Lead. It's written by a former Top Gun instructor, pilot, and CEO. The guy's name's Dave Burke. It's a leadership book, but more of his failures and what he's learned and what those failures taught him. And I fail early. I fail often. It's the nature of the thing. And so, you know, if you're not failing, that means you're not growing, you're not trying, you're not doing different things. Yeah. You're just kind of settling in, which is fine.
For sure.
But, you know, I'm not wired that way. I need to get better at whatever it is that I'm doing. And so
that's an interesting one. I think, I had a boss one time that was like, the industry doesn't need everybody that is going to be the next apps engineer or the next, like, there's a place that's what I love about this industry is there's a place for someone. And I freaking hate when people are like, oh, he's just anything, right?
Yeah.
Because the world needs a debugger, a programmer, a manager, and everything. Mm-hmm. Now I'm wired differently, you know, and that comes with actually pluses and minuses. So I love that. I added that to my listen list. I'm a gooder listener than I am a reader.
So I actually got, so he narrates it. So if you do the audiobook, he's actually the one that narrates it. And so
I appreciate that extra. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've awesome. Got the, so I have the book and I have it on, I got the audiobook too. Cause,
cool.
it two forms of thing.
Yeah. You
know, if it goes in here, I'm going to learn it a little better.
That's interesting. I might try that. I don't hate reading.
I read. That's an interesting. Ton.
Yeah.
Read. I really do read a lot.
Yeah. That's an interesting one. All right. Any personal or professional projects you're fired up about?
Well, Lance and I are trying to convince management to hire more engineers. That is a project because, you know, the reality is our department is expensive to run. It's not only expensive on our salaries and benefits and all of those things, but the travel. It costs our company money to, send us somewhere, get on an airplane, rent a car, rent a hotel. So, when people, complain about the cost of a machine, it's like, it's not just the machine. There's something behind it. And when you buy a Matsura or, you buy a machine from Selway Machine Tool, we actually have a department that is 100% dedicated to your contributing to your technical excellence. And that costs money.
I like to think we can share similar at Toolpath, a totally different dynamic, but we've, what appears as a tech startup software company, it appears as a pretty unbalanced technical people to support the company and support our customers. It's pretty uncommonly high as a support and tech people to customers. It's a pretty fundamental part of what Al and I believed in. So, I think that's it, James. I'll end with just another, how much I appreciate you, the industry. I know lots of people in the industry appreciate you. You are, I think, one of those people that started the trend of just being more open with sharing knowledge with everybody. When I got in the industry, I can almost say I can speak for you, but I'm sure when you got in the industry, knowledge was not freely shared. I know the MasterCamp forum, which I was on a very little bit, but just the energy that was on there was just I don't want to be a part of that energy. I think you and my buddy Joe Lillard met each other there. I remember I think that might be how I met Joe Lillard. Was like, oh, he's got an energy that I like. So with that, you're also on Instagram. How do people find you on Instagram, James?
CNC Apps James is my Instagram handle. That's, there you go. That's kind of my handle everywhere. I think I started off as CNC Apps Guy, and then I changed it to CNC Apps James.
I remember the Apps Guy. Yeah.
So that was me. I left eMastercam for a while because I had some disagreements with the guys running it, and I was like, I don't have to do this. I do this because I enjoy it, and you're making me not enjoy it. So I think I'm going to go do something else for a while. But what's funny, Andrew Selway was like, hey, you need to get back on there.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
That's the deal we've got an amazing community, right? And I'm sure Andrew's seeing that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So he said, hey, our customers are missing your presence. And, so why don't you go back and whatever? And I was like, okay, I can do that. I've learned too much over the years, and too many people have poured into me for me to keep it to myself. So I feel like, hey, I'm going to give it away. Hopefully somebody else gets better. And if they get better than me, awesome. They teach me some more stuff. So
I'm the same way. I kind of hated the online world of there's different forums and stuff. I was like, man, every time somebody asks a question, there's too much hate. So when I started Autodesk, my boss, Joe Bailey, you know Joe. He's like, hey, Timmy, I want you to get on some kind of social presence. I'm like, I hate social presence. I post pictures on Facebook for my mom, so I don't have to text my mom my pictures of my daughter, right? And CJ Abraham, our buddy CJ, was like, I was complaining to CJ about it while we were at the Portland machining show. And I was like, Joe, blah, 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 blah. And he was like, get on Instagram. It's the easiest one. It's like, you see rad stuff all day. Just post cool stuff that you're doing, and it's great. But from
I've actually got a few customers that is how they reach me. They don't email the company. They go through Instagram. Because I thought about dumping my Instagram, and I was like, no, I can't do that to them. So
I've done the same. All right, James. Well, let's wrap it up. Right. Thanks for everybody that listened. Thanks for everything you do for the industry. Thanks for your personal friendship, and look forward to the next time we see each other.
Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity to let me do what I enjoy doing. And
cheers, buddy.
It's awesome to know you, Tim, and I really appreciate what you do for us too.
Yeah. Cheers.